Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Telford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Telford.
Hello, hello. How's he feeling? How's he doing? How's he hanging?
I'm doing all right. Like we were talking about on the wind-up
Yes. Previously,
I've just come back from a holiday, and it was so busy, that holiday, that I now need a holiday from the holiday.
I feel like I need
to recoup from it. But otherwise, I'm feeling good. A lot of games out at the moment. Suddenly, a lot of news, video game-wise, out of nowhere. So I'm excited to chew on that today.
I feel like news, video game news, is a bucket that fills, and then occasionally someone just tips it over. And it's like, oh, there's nothing for a while, and then there's seven things that we need to get to. So we thought we'd do a news podcast. There are various things to talk about. Let's talk about Fallout 5, Josh Brown.
Do we have to, Scott?
Well, there's not that much to talk about, but it's worth touching on the fact that over on Den of Geek, there was an interview with Bethesda's Todd Howard saying the Fallout 5 is apparently completely mapped out, and he's been telling Jonathan Nolan what to do and what not to do for the Amazon TV show. Todd Howard said, there are some things where I said, don't do this because we're going to be doing it in Fallout 5, and Jonathan Nolan apparently now knows the entirety of Fallout 5, but isn't telling anyone. It's worth just dipping in on this because the state of Fallout has been a bit up and down.
Yes. With
Fallout 4 and then Fallout 76. The TV show looks extremely promising, at least I think it does. And then, obviously, you had Howard get out there and say that they were doing the next Elder Scrolls, and then they would do Fallout 5. But Howard himself was like, I don't know how many more of these I've got in me because of his increased age and the reality of how long these things take to make. So, there's reassurance that he knows what it is?
Yes and no. Like, to me, honestly, I don't like them talking about these projects so far in advance, especially when it's just lines like this, which are essentially just reassuring you that, yeah, it's on their mind, and yes, it is coming at some point. I like, have you not learned your lesson from announcing The Elder Scrolls 6 way before Starfield was even ready to go? Like, we'll have been waiting for that game probably at least 8 years by the time we get to play it, and that's a conservative estimate. That's like, really, you know, if everything goes well, that's when we'll be getting it in like 2026. So them talking about Fallout 5, which realistically we're probably not going to get for another decade, like at best case scenario, I just think, did they learn nothing from Fallout 4's launch? Like, yeah, I know a lot of people didn't necessarily love that game or think it was on the level of Skyrim or Fallout 3, but them announcing it 6 months before and having that really rapid hype cycle just, I thought, was incredible. I thought that was the route they were going to take going forward, but now it's almost like they've gone in the complete opposite direction, and now they're just saying, yeah, Fallout 5 is happening, it's coming, we've got some ideas about it. We're not going to tell you those ideas from probably 15 years, but we got them. We got them all right.
In the pipeline, I'm curious about the general feel of Bethesda to the modern day audience. Like, Bethesda used to be this massive titan, and they still kind of are, but they went through all the stuff with the acquisition. They went through everything that happened with Fallout 76. Starfield, me and you liked it. I feel like we're the only two people that did.
Yeah, every time I say I like Starfield on these videos and podcasts, everyone slags me off in the comments, and I'm like, I just thought it was a good game.
I thought it was a good fun time. I mean, I get the criticisms for it, but I just kind of accepted what they were going for, what they pulled off, kind of thing. And I had a lovely, lovely time with Starfield. Do think it has really good character writing. And I love the ending for it. But yeah, the way that Bethesda have gone, it makes me wonder whether they are this big head-turning thing like they were in the run-up to Fallout 4. Like, you couldn't move for the amount of people being psyched for Fallout 4.
Yeah.
And that was such a reset, potentially. And maybe it was always only going to go that way. Maybe the hype was too big and it was never going to capitalize on that. But I'm curious, does all that stuff happen again with Fallout 5, or have people been wounded too many times now?
I think it's going to depend on the Elder Scrolls, actually.
Yeah, like,
with that being their next game, with Skyrim still being so beloved today, and the Elder Scrolls brand as a whole, obviously, but it was Skyrim that really rocketed them up to, you know, rock star levels in terms of mainstream popularity. Like, Fallout 3 was, of course, a big deal, but Skyrim changed the world. It changed video games. It changed RPGs in a way. So Elder Scrolls 6 has so much riding on it, and that's either going to be a blessing or a curse. It's either going to mean that a lot of people are looking forward to it, so will be just pleased they have another Elder Scrolls game to play, or people are going to be more harshly critical on it because they're looking for the next Skyrim. And like you said, can Bethesda even, do they even have another Skyrim in them?
Do they even know what they're supposed to deliver as well?
Like, I'm not as sour on Bethesda as other people are. They had a spotty decade, absolutely. Fallout 4 could have been better, but I still really loved it. Starfield could have been better, but I still really loved it. I think if our expectations are a little bit lower, and we're not expecting another Skyrim or another Fallout 3, like, I think, you know, they're still capable of making good games. It's just the question of, do they deserve to be in the conversation amongst other RPG greats in their current form? That's something that is definitely worth discussing, because I think they currently are making very good 8 out of 10 games. And that's fine, man. That's better than most.
That's true. And I think there's a lot of charm that comes through them as well. The character, like I said, the character writing, the world writing, the world building is all so spot on. There was a lot of stuff that I really liked about Starfield. Fallout has just always been a weird IP for them, because they acquired it anyway from Black Isle, and then trying to make it their own, like the Bethesda Fallout era. You still get Fallout fans who love Fallout 1 and 2 and the feel of those old games. And it's just interesting seeing it all pan out, and then what the hell Fallout 5 even is, but at least one of the lead creatives has an idea for it.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'm a Fallout guy more than I am an Elder Scrolls guy, right? And I'm a big Elder Scrolls guy, you know what I mean? But Fallout, for me, Fallout 3 changed my life. Like, that its approach to post-apocalyptic fiction just got me into post-apocalyptic fiction as a whole. Like, got me reading books like The Road, got me seeking down post-apocalyptic films, and New Vegas is my favorite game of all time. Not made by Bethesda, of course, but that kind of continued my love of it. And like I said, I really love Fallout 4. I just worry that it's a long time between installments by the time Bethesda get around to making this. And I know they own the franchise. They bought it, like you said. To them, it's probably one of their babies. But, you know, I just don't know why they don't give us another New Vegas. Like, lend this IP out to another studio.
Obsidian.
It doesn't even, oh, yeah. I mean, specifically Obsidian I'm talking about here. But it doesn't even have to be an RPG in their style. Like, it could be something radically different. It could be a return to the isometric Fallout 1 and 2 style gameplay experiences. Something that doesn't necessarily infringe on what they're doing, but that just keeps Fallout in the conversation. I know they tried that with Fallout 76, which, you know, is in a much better place than it was at launch, but... Like, that's, to me, that's not enough. Like, this IP deserves, I think, more than a game every 10 or 15 years, you know?
Yeah, and that's always the secret sauce thing, is like, do they need that long to get all the different, the way the quest design works? Like, when the Radiant Quest system came in Skyrim, or the first time we realized it was generating quests infinitely, you can see they're watered down and they are generated. You're doing a little face there, Josh Brown.
No, you're absolutely right. And I'm actually let you finish, because I feel like I'm jumping in with facial expressions.
I didn't necessarily mean that was like a tip of the spear thing, but like, they had those ideas. Like, they used to be the leaders of the field, and like, Starfield didn't feel like it was leading anything.
That's true, man. And I think even Fallout 4 didn't feel like it was leading anything. I think even I can understand the criticism of that game, is that it's just more Fallout, right? It didn't reinvent the wheel in the same way that Skyrim did. Like, Skyrim's obviously indebted to Oblivion and previous games even before that, but it felt like it was really innovating on those ideas, taking them to a next level, whereas Fallout 4, as much as I love it, is kind of just Fallout 3 with more color and... building mechanic.
The god rays.
Stitched onto it. Yeah, amazing god rays. And a really lovely vault suit in that game. I can't remember what I was going to say. Yes, your point on, like, can they do this quicker? Like, is it too long of a time? I think they can do it quicker. I mean, look, Fallout New Vegas had so many problems at launch in terms of, you know, the technical aspects, the bugs, the glitches. It's kind of unforgivable in a way, but that game was made in 18 months. That game was made on an insane turnaround. And even if you know, Obsidian had 3 years to make it, which is way more rapid than what Bethesda is currently going on schedule-wise. Like, you might have been able to iron out those bugs and make a game that hits those 9s out of 10s on Metacritic, you know, because the core of Fallout New Vegas, the fact that that was made in 18 months, obviously it's built off the engine from Fallout 3, so a lot of the work was already done there. Like, that's an incredible game, and that is iterative. So I think, like, if Bethesda is making games currently that are more iterative than revolutionary in terms of their mechanics and their technology and stuff, like, yeah, would we take smaller, more focused games over something as sprawling as Starfield, which has 1,000 planets, but only a handful of them have really interesting content?
Yeah, that was the whole No Man's Sky thing at the beginning as well. It's, I think it's interesting, that whole idea of the ball that Bethesda set rolling, the idea of like this huge world, and obviously as technology has advanced and consoles have, the console cycles have played out and everything, what do people want from a Bethesda game? What even is a Bethesda RPG? I think that's why Starfield was a bit disappointing to a lot of people. But still, like, they assumedly can reclaim, they have all the money in the world now, they're backed by Microsoft, like, Fallout is a vested franchise. I'm curious to see how Avowed does from Obsidian, whether people take to that in the same way. I do think the industry has changed so much since 2011 that it's like, it's just hard wowing people in the same way. Like, every other week, there's another massive 100-hour RPG. Like, it's just not the same landscape.
That is absolutely, you know, you're absolutely spot on there, but I do think that all it takes is one great game to get a developer back on top. Like, we've seen it so many times before. Like, people hated CD Projekt Red, perhaps rightfully so, when Cyberpunk released.
Right.
But if you ask people now, like, have they done enough to reclaim their spots as at the top of the RPG pile with the work they put into Cyberpunk and the Phantom Liberty DLC? I think a lot of people would probably say, yeah, CD Projekt rule again, and they've made the mistakes, but now they're back on top, you know? We've seen it with developers coming in like Larian and dropping Baldur's Gate 3 and then being like massive, you know, darlings all of a sudden, and kind of entering the mainstream in that way. And I think that that is always a possibility. I think, you know, the great thing about games in a way is that someone could have a have an absolute stinker, be like, grab the baton of hate, which I know you like to say, for a few years, but then turn it around by saying, yeah, we messed up, but he's a great game we've been working on that kind of fixes those issues.
True.
And they can win that fan respect back.
Yeah, and I think like that can be one of the biggest issues with gaming, is that they get away with the price points that are associated with those initial salvos.
Absolutely true.
But they're always back. Let's talk about Battlefield. Battlefield's in a bit of a state at the minute. There's a few things to touch on here. We've had two lead creatives have left the Battlefield project in the spate of a few months. There's also been a cancelled Battlefield game, and that was a single-player game, apparently, which made a lot of people think that they were doing some sort of follow-up to Bad Company, Bad Company 2, which is some of the most revered Battlefield games of all time, especially Bad Company 2. Where are you at on this? And then we'll talk about the future of it. Do EA know what the hell's going on?
No. No, they don't, Scott Telford. And they haven't seemingly known what the hell they're doing with this franchise for about 8 years now.
Say,
you know, I infamously perhaps enjoyed the launch version of Battlefield 2042. Yeah, I always get those numbers mixed up every single time.
You got 2077.
Title, that's it. Anytime a title has a number on the end, I will get it mixed up. I enjoyed it for what it was, but it was very clear that that game was suffering from some kind of creative identity crisis. And the moves they made following that game's release, I thought were initially promising, you know, bringing Vince Zampella over from Respawn to act as the kind of, you know, shepherd that sheep. shepherd the Battlefield sheep into a new direction and kind of oversee it, I thought was a good move, you know, kind of restructuring the team in a way to focus on Battlefield's core principles rather than chasing trends, I thought was a promising step forward. Putting more games into development that do things differently, like the single-player games, I thought was a promising development. But now in the years since, like you said, we've seen these creative directors leave. We've now seen projects cancelled, and it makes me fear for what Battlefield 2025 is going to be, because EA has said the next Battlefield is coming then.
Right.
And I just worry about it. Like, what does EA think Battlefield is, and what does DICE and the other teams working on the franchise want it to be? Because a lot of the leads who worked on, you know, iconic games like Bad Company and Battlefield 3 and Battlefield 4, like, they're no longer at that studio anymore.
Right.
So going forward, I just want them to make a Battlefield game. Like, just go back to basics for once. People loved Battlefield 1. People love Battlefield 2. People love Battlefield 3. They love the class system. There is a fandom there. But I think this franchise, perhaps more than any other right now, was emblematic of what we've been talking about for the past few weeks in terms of AAA publishers and AAA developers like wanting all of the money and not being concerned with what they deem smaller successes. Like EA forever has wanted Battlefield to go toe-to-toe with Call of Duty.
Yes.
And even though it's never sold Call of Duty numbers, it's still sold incredibly well. It's still sold like 15, 20 million copies at its peak. And that's nothing to sniff at when you have microtransactions on top and you have this, you know, multiplayer dedicated fan base that will be with you for the entire duration. And it's like, can we just make a Battlefield again? Can we just make one? And if people don't like it, fair enough, EA, do whatever the hell you want. Yeah. But I guarantee people will like it.
The thing I want to touch on is like 2042 felt like they were chasing the remnants of the Overwatch model, like the operator stuff, trying to have like, I mean, I know Rainbow Six Siege, you can argue maybe they were chasing that or something instead, but having like individual characters, individual players, like take on all these roles as opposed to a cumulative way that you progress through a match. Like to me, the last time the Battlefield turned heads was the operators, sorry, the operations mode in Battlefield 1. That was 2016.
I know, and that was great as well. It is a long, long time. And it's been such a quick decline. You know, we were just talking about Bethesda and how it only takes one game to get back on top. It was a quick decline for Battlefield because people love Battlefield 3, people love Battlefield 4. Battlefield 1 kind of rocked the world and how good it was. And then we started the decline with Battlefield 5, which really dropped off, and then 2042, which dropped off even further. And it's like, how do you go from the peak to the bottom of the barrel in two games? Like, that's what I always wonder. So I have faith that, you know, one great game can rocket them back up. But with all of the turmoil clearly happening behind the scenes, I wonder, again, what they want out of this franchise.
The thing is that you play way more COD than I do. Like, I try and keep up with Call of Duty, but I don't play Warzone. And I didn't actually buy Modern Warfare 3. It was the first one I didn't buy in years. But the way Call of Duty is at the minute, every now and then when I see a gameplay clip or I see something, it's like a character, like Homelander's killing someone, or like there's a whole bunch of guest characters, Nicki Minaj is in there, Walking Dead skins, whatever it is. And I see Call of Duty, I see Activision chasing the Fortnite dollar, chasing the brand crossover dollar. And assumedly in that, it depends how much that idea has been normalized in that space.
Yeah.
But I wonder how much EA are like, oh, we need all these crossover deals and we need it to be this multi-media behemoth thing. And it can never be World War II because all World War boots on the ground stuff because it needs to accommodate all these brand deals.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they navigate that because recently, I think it was an Insider Gaming report suggested that there's going to be a free-to-play Battle Royale mode shipping with the next Battlefield, which, like you said, is very Call of Duty in nature. But I think because Call of Duty is, you know, making that approach of trying to chase the Fortnite crossover gimmick of putting, you know, Rick Grimes in there, Ash Williams from The Evil Dead.
He plays King Kong.
Yes, Snoop Dogg's in there, Nicki Minaj is in there. You know, they've got that crossover appeal. I do think that's left part of the first-person shooter fandom kind of craving for a game that doesn't have that stuff, something that is not necessarily a military simulator or anything like that, not a milsim, but, you know...
Hell, that loose proves that does have an audience, though.
That's it, right? Yeah. You look on the subreddit for Call of Duty Warzone, and while, you know, I'm actually a fan of those crossover skins and stuff, I think it's fun. Rightly so, some people are like, I just kind of want to play, like, a modern warfare game. I want to play something that is that modern military, that has that modern military aesthetic. And while Battlefield has never been, you know, the most hardcore military game, never been the most realistic, it's always had that edge and always had that reputation over something like Call of Duty. You know, it's a little bit weightier. It's got the destruction element. It's kind of more focused in on the kind of what could be described as a more hardcore experience, even though it's still very casual. So, like, that's, to me, that's the market Battlefield should be aiming for. Because if it does just have a free-to-play Battle Royale experience that is trying to catch that crossover audience that Call of Duty already has, like, you're going to fail because it's Call of Duty. You can be the best, but if you're also putting Nicki Minaj skins in, people are just going to go, well, Call of Duty's doing that. What are you offering me as an alternative? You know?
Yeah, that audience is already satiated anyway. Like, no, does anyone want a Battlefield Battle Royale?
I would take it.
Yeah.
I would take it, but they've missed the boat on it by about 5 years.
It feels ancient
late
at this
to the
point.
Party, yeah. And when Call of Duty already has such a... a huge part of the market when Fortnite is still going strong with a huge part of the market. Like, it's a tough market to break into. It absolutely is.
I remember when Cliffy B, Cliff Blazinski, Gears of War creator, was talking about trying to get into a certain competition space. He was like, the market tends to only have space for two leaders. That back in the day, you know, you had just Sega Nintendo, or Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, or whatever. And there's obviously more than two, but like the two biggest titans tend to lead the way. And at the minute, in this space, it's Call of Duty and Fortnite, in regards to the cross-brand crossover stuff.
Yeah.
They feel like the two titans of like free-to-play, live servers, multiplayer shooter stuff. And like, yeah, for me, the only way forward would be doubling down on the things that you know, which would contrast what the big wigs would want over at EA, because it wouldn't be, let's do ostensibly a deluxe version of what Hell Let Loose is right now, which is in itself what Battlefield used to be. So like, I don't know how you bring it back in a way that'll get the player numbers or like a big enough hit, which is, I guess, why things, big lead creatives are abandoning stuff, like they're cancelling games, because the people at the top won't know how the hell it even is anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And then various projects get off the ground, then they get canned because they're not going to be big enough.
On a wider level as well, I think, you know, EA's approach to live services or even multiplayer games, they don't have the same commitment to it as even an Activision does. Like, I don't necessarily love every Call of Duty season and update, but you know they're always going to have something. You know those seasons are coming. You know that they've got them in advance. You know there'll be a Halloween event, for instance, or a Christmas event. And even when, you know, they do those silly boys crossovers, there are new game modes, there are new skins, there are new ways to play. Like, there are plans in motion. You kind of... you believe in it as a live service. You don't think it's... like, you couldn't imagine Call of Duty Warzone just ending abruptly.
No.
Whereas if you look at what EA has done with Battlefield and Battlefront and some of their other live service and multiplayer games, I don't have the confidence that that support will be there in a big way. Like, they've done a good job turning around games like Battlefield 5 and Battlefield 2042. Like, they've supported that game for longer than I thought they would. But the content drops haven't been as substantial as you'd maybe want, and certainly not as substantial as you'd want from a live service game. So even if they launched Battlefield Battle Royale and it was amazing at launch, I'd still be wary about its long-term support, because just as Battlefront 2, Star Wars Battlefront 2, was getting into an excellent place, they stopped support. They moved those developers onto the next Battlefield. And that happened with Battlefield 5 as well. You know, EA seems to have a cutoff point for these live services and multiplayer games in terms of their active support. So I worry, like, if you launch Battlefield Battle Royale, even if it's well received, even if it gets those numbers, I'd still be worried about it surviving beyond 2 or 3 years. And I think if it sells underneath that, or if it doesn't get the same players as a Call of Duty, it might last even less and the content will be even more sparse.
That whole thing with Battlefront 2 was fascinating, because that game launched in a horrible state. Like, all the premium currency stuff that had to be gutted out of it. It was under legal investigation. They were potentially being sued or whatever by the Hawaiian lawyer. There was all that stuff. And then years later, it just became the best Star Wars multiplayer game ever. Like, it looks gorgeous. It plays really well, etc. And then, like you said, they canned it. And it just felt like this thing of like, okay, we need to polish this back up to the point where people are smiling at it again, and then we move on, because we need the new unit sales, we need the new whatever the next step is. But for whatever reason, they didn't double down on the thing that they always say they're aiming for, which is a sustainable live service model. You could have reintroduced monetization to Battlefront 2, and maybe they looked at the metrics and it was like, that's just going to be another press storm and we don't want it and whatever, and maybe the state of the Star Wars IP wasn't strong enough or something like that. But with Battlefield 2042, they did it again, and it's like, you get it back to a point where people are smiling again, and then you just move on from it. You just don't do it properly, and it just feels like such a pointless endeavor, like every time, over and over again.
I think with Battlefield especially, it feels like, yes, they support the games, yes, they put in new patches, even drop new content, but it always feels like they're just making up for, in a way, what should have been there at launch. Yes. And they get it to the state where it should have been, they add some new content, some new vehicles, some new skins and stuff, and then go, right, okay. But as a player, you're thinking, well, it should have been like that at launch, and then you should have added more on top. And I know video game development's hard, but with DICE especially, this has been the cycle for 10 years. Even a game I love, like Battlefield 4, you know, its servers were absolutely busted at launch. Like, that took a lot of work to get to the game it should be, and now it is, you know, viewed as a complete classic of the franchise. Mm-hmm. But yeah, with Battlefront 2, my brain can still not fathom that they stopped support of that game just as Disney was about to release a bunch of Star Wars content. And I know, like you said, maybe the brand wasn't as strong, but in terms of stuff that they then had to pull from, the fact that we didn't get a proper Mandalorian crossover is crazy. The fact that we didn't have Andor Jaw stuff, or what else are they? Bad Batch stuff, you know, all of these things that they had to play with, all of these tools in their toolbox that even if you didn't like the shows or watch the shows, would have made great content, tent drops, you know, new characters, new maps. They had a bigger player base than ever, and they were like, nah.
My Star Wars rule is always that Star Wars in video games is better than Star Wars in live action anyway, but yeah, they absolutely could have done. Let's talk about emulation. Emulation, my favorite words on the planet. And this is according to various leaks that were on a LinkedIn, and that Sony are looking to work with a renowned emulation software, piece of software called PCSX2, which a lot of people already know. That's how you access PlayStation 2 games on emulation, depending on wherever you're doing your business. But apparently Sony are looking to work with them officially to bring a far wider swath of PS2 games to PlayStation 5. This was written up by known leaker XStasis over on Twitter, saying that Sony are strengthening relationships with PCSX2 emulator workers to bring more PS2 games to the PS5. The association would also be with third parties to make more backwards compatible titles. This feels like a direct response to, one, Jim Ryan stepping down, the dude that didn't want to prioritize this stuff whatsoever, and two, the general ongoing conversation around how terrible the PlayStation Premium tier is of PlayStation Plus, because that whole thing is sold on the idea of accessing archives of titles, especially for console libraries like the PS2, and it's just threadbare. And even the stuff that is on there, like Ape Escape 2 or whatever, runs like hell.
Yeah.
So they are far better embracing the emulation side of things, which is the complete opposite right now of what Nintendo are doing with Yuzu, where they've just sued them for millions of dollars, which is a whole thing you can get into. It's they've got a case, whatever. But still, if you can find a way to give people access to their memories and playable versions of old games, that's a net positive.
You know what? Sometimes, very rarely, but I have to admit it sometimes, I am very wrong about things, and you are very, very right about things. And PlayStation Plus Premium is kind of one of those, because when that system was launched, when that service was launched, I was all in on it. I still think it's a great service if you want to go back and play through PS3 games, especially in those games that aren't immediately accessible. Like, I love the fact that you can go on and play the old God of Wars on there. You've got some of the old Tekkens on there. Like, if you're into that part of gaming history, it is amazing. But as a monthly service, I think it has been let down by its lack of commitment to those PlayStation Classics, as they're called, because I've liked a lot of the PlayStation 1 games that have arrived on the service. You know, Star Wars The Phantom Menace, Toy Story 2 is on there, the Siphon Filter games. I've got a nostalgia hit, but nowhere near to the degree that I was expecting them to deliver it. You know, at the start of the service, I kept saying to you, like, it's early days. It's no longer early days now. And, you know, one kind of obscure PS1 game every month, like, just doesn't
every
cut
5 months.
Yeah, it doesn't quit for that service, I don't think. Like, I think it's a great service if there's something you want to play and you want to get it for a month. I still do that myself, but as a rolling monthly subscription, they don't have those games, I think, to justify that repeat payment every single month. And as a result, I've knocked my own subscription down to just the essential one until there is a game that I want to play, because there's so much vying for our attention right now, and the nostalgia library they have on there just isn't as good as it could be. Think about the library that PlayStation has. How do they not have Tekken 3 on there? Like, how do they not have those big hitters on that service that would get you interested in paying that premium?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yeah, man. We said, like, when, because the thing is, when the PlayStation 5 was about to come out, there was various patents registered as to bringing old school game libraries to the PS5, including PSP, including PS Vita. And the assumption was that they would do some sort of monthly service that would give you access to either entire console libraries at once. Oh, this month it's PS1 fighting game month, and you just have a whole bunch of stuff on there, put Bloody Roar on there, whatever, and you just rotate that stuff out. Like, in theory, I mean, I know that they have to go back and, like, relicense a whole bunch of deals. I get that, and I get that it's not as simple as just putting it on PS5 either. Hence, yeah, like, why a lot of PS2 games run like hell on the PS5. They need to be re-engineered. There's a lot of R&D that's going to go into that, as Xbox testify to when they bring old games back for the new series systems. But at the same time, you've got a legacy. There's a lot of love there. Make it work. Like, I get the, to me, the main comparison is Nintendo. They do exactly what I would want from a legacy service. It's like, here's the Game Boy Advance launcher, and here's a library of like 30 games on Game Boy Advance, and we'll add to it every few months. A Game Boy launcher, NES launcher, SNES, N64 launches that are all just nicely placed on your home console menu. It's the perfect way to jump into console libraries. And I wonder if that's what they're getting close to. If Sony loves one thing, it's ripping off Nintendo or ripping off whatever's popular. And now that they've seen how it's supposed to be done, I mean, even this last week on Mario Day, Nintendo added more Game Boy Color Mario games and like Mario Golf and stuff that are just nice to see. They're nice to have.
Yeah,
like, one's asking you to sit and complete the whole thing, but they're good bridging games in between other stuff.
Precisely, man. And I think, you know, I understand bringing those games back is probably too much hassle if you're just selling them. Like, I still think they should be there. I still think it's worth it from a archival point of view and an access point of view. But I think they really are essential to retention when it comes to subscriptions, because games now are so big, like I said, so much vying for our attention. Like, why... In a world where streaming services are so rampant and they're getting pricier and it's getting so costly to have all of these on the go at the same time, like, what is Sony giving us in that tier that justifies having it every single month? I know you've got game trials, for instance. Mm-hmm. I personally don't use those, but I like that they're there. Is that enough to justify a monthly subscription?
Like, I don't think so.
I don't think so either. Like I said, I think the competition is too fierce, and this is a great way to help bridge that gap. Like, give them a handful of nostalgic hits every single month. Make PlayStation Premium the place to be for unlocking that archive that PlayStation has that people love, in the same way that Nintendo is kind of doing right now by giving people like those Game Boy games, those Game Boy Advance games that they can jump into. And again, you know, they might not play more than a couple of hours, but if those couple of hours to those people justify another month at that price point, Sony's won. You know, like, that's
it's like, you talk about why, or people talk about why Nintendo get away with so much, and it's because they nail the overall feel of feeling good that you bought a Nintendo console in the first place. Like, maybe they're not supplanting you with I'm not running out to the stores to get Mario versus Donkey Kong, but I should be, kind of thing. But like, still, in the way that they handle what it feels like to own a Switch, they are supplanting you with these classics. They're reminding you of the remakes. They're reminding you of their history. It feels good to be a Nintendo fan because you're reminded of all this stuff and this legacy. PlayStation's last few years, the Jim Ryan era, has been cold AF. They've not bothered doing anything like that whatsoever. It's just been live service stuff and business decisions and arbitrary sequels and whatever. And like, to me at least, it's been a very, very cold few years. years in comparison to something like the Sean Layden era or whatever. Layden himself is out there doing various conversations on the unsustainability of the current AAA market as well, talking about exclusivity as being an Achilles heel to the live service model. That's a whole other conversation in that. I think it's very much ongoing at the minute. But the state of Sony, those little wins, those little open goals, like you already own so many titles. Get the Sly Cooper collection on there. Get those things out there.
Well, to be fair, Scott Tilford, the Cooper collection is on the premium tier and it's on the PlayStation 3 HD. And you've got to stream it.
Horrible.
I'm fine with that. This guy is absolutely not. No, you're absolutely right. Like, I think with if we're looking at streaming service versus streaming service of Game Pass versus PlayStation Plus, the only thing really differentiating them right now is like a couple of titles that one might not have that the other has. And I think Xbox, to their credit, has smashed it out the park when it comes to getting exciting day one exclusives that might not be first party and leveraging the many amounts of studios that they currently own. Like, if you look at how many developers they own and the back catalog that comes with them, when they start, you know, properly getting into this Activision deal and start putting those games on Game Pass, like, they're just going to be almost unrivaled in terms of those cross-platform games that are kind of now becoming more associated with Xbox. And Sony can't combat that. They can't suddenly, it wouldn't even make business sense to suddenly buy up a bunch of studios themselves just to put their games on PlayStation Plus. Like, that model wouldn't sustain it, but they can leverage their past. And if they get PlayStation Plus, I think, feeling more like a PlayStation dedicated subscription as opposed to just a game subscription, it gives them a USP. It gives them a unique selling point. It gives them something that Xbox obviously can't or won't try to mimic, and it makes those services more different, and it makes buying into one or over the other more appealing. Because right now, you know, for a few months I had both services, and it just, when I looked at my bloody outgoings in my bank account, I just thought, but why? They share so many games. I'm not even playing that many anyway. Why not just cancel them and jump into one when one has a specific game that I want to play? That's the current mindset that I have.
I think a lot of people are adapting to that in terms of just streaming catalogs in general, like trying to keep up with seven different subscription services that then adds up to paying like £100, $100, whatever it is every month, regardless. You are better off just spacing stuff out. What's going on with Ghost Recon, Josh Brown?
Scott Tilford, you know how Ubisoft kind of likes to just put all of their franchises into a little magic eight ball and just shake it around and then just like spew out whatever other gaming influences come out of that. Well, they've got a new Ghost Recon game in production, apparently.
It is about
according
time.
To Insider Gaming and reporting from Tom Henderson over there. According to his sources, this thing is called Project Over at the minute. That's the code name it's currently being developed under. Apparently, it's targeting a 2025 to 2026 release date, which is much sooner than I expected. And it's making some big changes to the Ghost Recon format. Instead of being a third-person game like the past 10, 15, maybe even 20 years of Ghost Recon, it's going first-person. It's being described as having a heavy emphasis on more tactical gameplay. Again, kind of more like the original games. And with Tom Henderson's reporting, he describes it, quote, almost milsim-like in nature. However, the thing that I was getting to before this in terms of the influences, I actually think that part of it sounds promising.
Like, it reminds me of Advanced Warfighter, the last time the Ghost Recon was like on top of the world.
Yeah, man, like going back to a more tactical approach, not just having it be an arbitrary open world or trying to water down those elements to make it more like Far Cry or more like Assassin's Creed or whatever. That to me is a way better approach than when they announced a Ghost Recon Battle Royale game and everyone hated it and it was cancelled. However, this is where I have an issue, because in the report, he also says, quote, the game appears to take heavy inspiration from the Modern Warfare series with some potential dark or controversial missions and segments. Okay. One mission, for example, shows your squad nearly shooting a man holding a baby because they thought that baby was a bomb, but they realize this at the last second, end quote. They also say that it's taken inspiration from the likes of Ready or Not, which is a PC multiplayer shooter, and more kind of, like I said, tactical games like that.
Okay.
And I understand that all games need inspirations, but when you're describing a mission like that and talking about how much you're kind of pulling from Modern Warfare, I don't just want to Ghost Recon game that's just a worse feeling version of Modern Warfare, man.
I think this is fascinating because I feel like for me and you, we've played every single Ghost Recon. Like
I
feel like growing up with the franchise, like I've been there since the beginning. What, like the Advanced Warfighter era was a huge deal. Like that was such a, oh my God, look what the 360 can do era. Future Soldier I actually quite liked. I like all the cross-sync stuff in terms of telling your entire squad to fire at once. It was the Splinter Cell, Mark and Execute stuff. And then keeping up with Wildlands and then Breakpoint. Breakpoint was my breaking point in terms of... Bullet My Valentine came to my mind there because they have a song called Breaking Point.
There you go.
But still, the way that franchise went, where it was, like you said, it was chasing the Far Cry stuff. It was chasing the Ubisoft open world template. And it's not that there wasn't fun to be had in Wildlands or Breakpoint, mainly because of how kind of broken and busted the physics were. It's just like you and the boys tipping down a hill in an SUV or whatever.
Did love that in Wildlands.
Fun enough, but like it didn't have the DNA. It didn't have why we're here in the first place. Whereas something like Rainbow Six, because back in the day, it used to always feel, at least to me, like Ghost Recon and Rainbow Six were the two franchises mentioned side by side. They were like the two big Tom Clancy franchises. And then Splinter Cell came in. And it hasn't had that feel in 20 years. So I quite like the idea of them at least broaching, getting back to that. I think for me, the ideal Ghost Recon era is Warfighter, where you've got squad tactics, but you also have technology that is a little bit more advanced and lets you plan in different ways that differentiates it from Call of Duty or whatever. So I wonder how much they want it to be a boots-on-the-ground standard first-person shooter, tactical shooter, like the Band of Brothers game or whatever.
Yes.
I kind of wonder, because like those are bygone ways of adding mechanics to what used to be the first-person shooter template, and now everything just chases Modern Warfare or tries to chase the sort of the momentum shooter, that kind of thing, which Ghost Recon isn't that. So bringing in the moral quandary stuff is interesting, but the example given there is so close to Modern Warfare 2019's one.
Yeah, right.
Of, are you going to shoot the baby? Is it a criminal? Yeah. Like, I just hope it can be differentiable again.
That's exactly my issue with this, and I'm kind of conflicted about this whole report because, on the one hand, going back to first person, being more tactical, great. Mm-hmm. Even being influenced by Modern Warfare, which I really love that game, and I even controversially like Modern Warfare 2 as well. I like the kind of cinematic approach of those games. I like those more tactical levels, if you could call them that, when they're a bit more focused and you have that squad. But I worry about Ubisoft as a sort of creative whole, because I look at this in the comparisons to Modern Warfare and how it's taking inspiration from that franchise and Ready or Not and a bunch of other games. And I pine for the days, and I don't even know if these ever existed, but I have to assume they did, when Ubisoft was, an innovator, where they were a leader, a creative leader in the medium, and they were using these franchises to invent new things and begin trends rather than just follow them. And that's my issue with their games at the minute. Like, why does everything have to be so heavily influenced by something else that's already popular? Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of vibe that I'm getting from this report, because, Modern Warfare sells like gangbusters. People love the aesthetic of that 2019 game. And Ghost Recon, it could be more than that. Totally. Of course, it could take elements from it and be inspired by it. But if it's just chasing that trend, that's where I get worried, because I'm so sick of Ubisoft games that are just chasing other games and feeling like worse versions of them.
That's the thing. They've become the snake eating their own tail. Like the trend they're chasing is something they set in motion, and then they just do it over and over again until it's run into the ground. Whereas, if you go back long enough, Assassin's Creed was breaking new ground. Far Cry 3 was breaking new ground. Far Cry 2 was breaking new ground. You have all like their 2000s era. It's not that it's unmatched, but it was a hell of an era. And obviously then they just re-cash back in on all the advancements that were made during that decade. But that's also when Advanced Warfighter was doing the rounds, and when Ghost Recon was, like I said, that was such a head turner back in the day.
Yeah, man.
And I feel like, not that everything should be a nostalgia play, I hate that stuff, but I feel like you can pull from that era of Ghost Recon and do something more tactile. That is also down the vein of Rainbow Six Vegas.
Yeah.
Like, another really cool tactical shooter. You can maybe argue, and maybe they have the data for it, that tactical shooters have had their day, and the kids want, momentum shooters, and they want Warzone, and they want Nicki Minaj shooting stuff. Maybe that's just the era that we're in, and I'm curious about that. But it's not like we didn't have other wins alongside it. I cite the Band of Brothers game because it's phenomenal. It's on backwards compatibility now as well, or it has been for a few months. That game's awesome, and I would love more differentiation in the space. I don't want everything to just chase COD.
No, absolutely.
Sick of fish.
I fully agree. You mentioned very nice, very nice. Well, I might have a chippy tea tonight. I might get my order in. Absolutely. You mentioned there, how the trend now is kind of more momentum shooters, momentum-based shooters. But even that, that only came because people started getting sick of military shooters.
Yeah.
And then a game took a risk and then reminded people why they loved that brand of FPS in the first place. Like, Doom 2016 was such a breath of fresh air because it wasn't a modern military shooter, and it was embracing the old-school FPS ethos. Same with Wolfenstein and The New Order. Like, two critically acclaimed reboots that took inspiration from older games and got huge success. So yeah, why can't the tactical shooter? In an age where we love games like PUBG, which are more punishing, and Escape from Tarkov, which are more punishing, like, why can't we go back to that in the mainstream? Like, why do we have to keep chasing other trends? And I hope this manages to thread the needle of being cinematic and also re-embracing older traditions. But I think of Rainbow Six, which to me is like maybe the only Ubisoft win in over a decade. Like, that is a game that genuinely felt different from them. It's still had its problems at launch, especially, but releasing a, you know, multiplayer-focused Rainbow Six game that's turned into this massive live service and was a success and cultivated this dedicated fan base. Like, to me, I'm like, why did we not get more risks like that? That was clearly a success. It's been going for 10 years.
Yeah.
It was an impressive reboot. But at every other franchise, Ubisoft just kind of went, oh, we'll do a Battle Royale.
Do you want another one?
Do you want another one? We'll do another open world game with towers and stuff. Do you want Watch Dogs? But now it's actually just Assassin's Creed, which is actually just Far Cry.
Yeah.
Far Cry 6 is out, which is just Far Cry 3 again. We've been doing this for 14 years. Somebody kill me.
Look, we got Vast back. We're doing it even again. I think if something like Helldivers 2 has proven anything, it's that people will work together. You can do squad shooters where there's tactile options in there and it can work really well. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth sales are apparently not doing very well. However, it's an ongoing conversation. I wanted to bring this up because it is something that I'm noticing with various conflicting reports, let's say, online. However, a lot of it hinges on digital sales versus physical. We have GamesIndustry.biz's Christopher Dring mentioning that Rebirth sales are down 30% physically compared to Remake back in 2020. Only in the UK, though. Physical sales in Japan... Sorry, I said that the 30% is what's down in the UK. Sales are also down in Japan, but we're still dealing with physical stuff. In Japan, 2020's Final Fantasy VII Remake sold around 700,000 units in its first week. Final Fantasy XVI then sold 336,000, so it was a whole thing that was then debated across last year as to whether 16 was a bomb or a failure or whatever. Apparently, in the end, internally, it was just referred to as, it's fine. Mm. It did okay, could have done better, could have done worse, it was all right. But that was 336,000, which is in itself less than half of Remake. And then now, Rebirth has sold less than that at 262,000 units, but again, it's all physical sales. So we haven't got the digital stuff at all. However, if you look at the way that the best-selling games were represented on the PlayStation Store, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth did get the number 2 slot in the US and Europe behind Helldivers, and that was within like a day. It released on the last day of February, and it shot all the way up to number 2. So there's a bit of a disparity between how badly it's doing physically and assumedly how well it's doing digitally. And there's a whole thing with Sony don't really release their digital numbers unless they have something to sing about. So that's an ongoing thing. However, I wanted to throw in, this is just something I was looking at last week, the trophy data for this game. Like, if you look at the amount of people that finished Remake, only 34% of people actually got through that last chapter. And if you look at the current trophy data for Rebirth, even the people that are picking it up, 50% of people have dropped off after chapter 4.
Yeah.
Like, of 14 chapters. And we're only a week in.
Yes.
But it's Final Fantasy, for F's sake. Like, it's one of the biggest IPs, one of the most diehard, dogged fandoms. I do think there's a conversation brewing here as to the approach for the Remake, the way, how dragged out a lot of the game is. And I think some of that is seen in the sales. Like I said, I think it's an ongoing thing. I just think it's interesting in terms of where we're at the minute.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm a little bit conflicted on this myself. Mm. I always feel compelled to defend it because I'm with you and I understand everything you just said. But yeah, to me, 30% down on physical sales, I am confident that will be made up by digital sales compared to the original game.
It's worth saying that 90% of all sales in the UK are digital overall.
Yeah,
so
that's it, right? Like you mentioned, you know, it was number 2 on the PS Store after only a couple of days of release. You know, if we can argue if that number in total will be an underperformance for a game called Final Fantasy VII, I think that is definitely worth talking about. Mm. But yeah, also when it comes to like the trophy data as well, again, it's another area where I understand
we
where
talk
you're
about this
loads.
Like,
we absolutely do, but I always cut it some slack because I think, and I mean this in the nicest way, a percentage of the gaming population are freaks like us who will put 50 hours into something in week one, even if it is as big as Final Fantasy.
Oh, you can see like people didn't even finish their first fight. Like the stuff that should be 100% is never 100%.
That's it, right? So, you know, I the trophy data stuff, I think in a year's time, I think the direct comparisons will be interesting then because, people might be dropping off. It's a big game. from what I've heard from you, it sounds like there's a lot of filler in there. Like, I would understand if people dropped off. It's just, with all this data, maybe I'm cutting them too much slack, but I feel like it's almost too early to tell. You know, it's only been out a week and a bit. And I'll be interested to see going forward. I do think overall it's interesting to watch those declining sales in Japan because, you know, even something like Final Fantasy 16, that was only last year where digital sales were just as... you know, important, and that was also just a PlayStation 5 exclusive like this game is. So there's definitely comparisons to be made there. And I do think, like, I don't know, from the sounds of it, from the reviews that this game is getting, from it being the second part of Final Fantasy VII's remake trilogy, I did personally expect it to be a bit higher, but I don't think the sales are disastrous.
I'm just curious about it. Like, if you look at the history of Final Fantasy sales in Japan especially, they used to sell millions for the original titles. There was a huge drop-off after Final Fantasy 13, but there's also that whole thing about the shift in the market, the access to digital copies, and the fact that physical is more easily tracked than digital overall. But you can point to the general lack of interest in Final Fantasy in Japan, or the general lack of interest in PlayStation in Japan after they moved, Sony moved their HQ to San Francisco, or they moved it out of Japan. And so I think there's an interesting thing there where, like, if Final Fantasy isn't hitting in Japan, it feels like this massive deal. But in terms of just raw sales data and raw unit sales, remakes sold better in other territories anyway, like in the West. You can argue it's geared more towards a Western audience anyway. Like, they've got away from turn-based combat. They're giving you this more Devil May Cry style thing, which is what 16 doubled down on, which then sold better in the West overall. Like, you can see them aiming for a different audience, and that probably will pay off in the digital sales. However, yeah, I'm curious how it all plays out. And in general, the conversation around Rebirth, yes, the review scores are high, but the stuff that I'm seeing is people going, how the hell are they this high?
Right,
so I'm just curious. I haven't finished it yet. I'm on chapter 12. I'm about halfway through it. I've got a couple more chapters to go. And I'm just curious how it all feels holistically. But something feels really fishy with the way this whole thing's rolling out.
This might sound stupid, right? Because I played middle chapters of games before that I know are middle chapters where you know more is probably coming. I mean, Gears of War 2, one of my favorite games ever. Metal Gear Solid 2, one of my favorite games ever. But there's something about Rebirth very specifically being the middle part of something that already exists and I know will have a proper end in a few years that, to me, as a sort of non-fan, even though I've loved Final Fantasy VII Remake, like, it feels more inessential. It feels like I don't have to be playing it right now and smashing through the story.
That's a really good point,
in a week. It feels like it's something I can get to almost whenever, especially in, like, this month, which is absolutely flushed with games and coming off last month, which was flush with games as well. Like, I find myself more drawn to Dragon's Dogma 2 than I do Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, even though I'm excited to play both.
I think they would counteract that with all the Big Aerith stuff. Like, it was on the front of the Washington Post. Like, they were trying to hang the whole thing on get through the game because something's going on with the story, and, like, it's the most iconic plot twist in gaming history. And, like, it's gaming's, Vader's Luke's father moment, everything else. That's why I'm getting through the damn thing, to see what the hell they've done. I think they've tried to hang it on that. I do agree with you, though, that there is that feeling of, like, well, it's fundamentally a middle space between two bookends that are more plot focused, even though a lot happens in the middle chunk of seven. It isn't the intro or the outro, so maybe that's a factor as well. I just think that the way that it's rolled out, for me, that 34% of people finishing the first one, that's a big deal. And I remember when that game came out, a lot of people didn't even realize that the game was split, that it wasn't the full game. Like, it's called Final Fantasy VII Remake, and then it cuts off after the intro. So I wonder if there's more of a disdain, there's more of a general conversation from the average gamer who isn't that vocal about it, just going, I'm all right, I don't need this.
I think there probably is, you know. I mean, Final Fantasy VII, for as much as I loved it, like, I can see why people would go, I don't necessarily need more of that right now.
The end
now
of it because, is ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I love it.
I'm along for the ride.
But yeah, it's...
Good Lord.
It's not... In what is a great way for me, it's not the Final Fantasy VII remake that perhaps a lot of people wanted. And again, this might be my own personal perception. I'm not even saying the game is reflective of this, just from an outsider looking in, you know, weighing up all of the games. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth kind of feels like, an important MCU installment, but not Avengers Endgame. Like, whatever the trilogy capper is, that will, to me, feel more like an Avengers Endgame of I need to see what this is. Whereas this seems like, again, in a good way, like Spider-Man No Way Home, which is still big, but it's not Avengers Endgame.
That's true, but I also think, I don't know what you've seen on your particular algorithmic feed, but I don't feel like word of mouth is strong. I feel like critical reception was strong, whereas people getting hands-on are like, oh, this is bloated as hell, there's so many mini-games, the open world design is horrible, this thing feels ancient, and I'm very much saying that myself anyway, so maybe that's why I'm getting a lot of that stuff. But I feel like now that people are starting to play it, they're noticing the negatives far more than the positives.
Right.
And I think that might also be like, you know, hurting word of mouth, maybe word of, I'm not seeing hardly anything. Like, if I compare launch weeks, look at how much Helldivers 2 was everywhere. Elden Ring was everywhere. Like, these huge, huge titles that dominate. I don't feel like Rebirth is dominating. It's kind of just there. And that might be what you said about people who are just going to get there over time. But it is a bit fishy. I just feel like the whole thing's a bit weird, and I think feel like when we finally get eyes on the digital sales, or just more sales over time, it might be more like 16, where it just settles as a divisive installment in an otherwise veteran franchise. Because 16's tale has been people going like, well, I either loved it or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm in the loved it camp, but like I just wonder with like, this is just maybe the way this is going to go.
It's interesting in that regard, because I wonder how much of it is like an algorithm thing, because I personally, again, seen more chatter about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth than I did 16, but that could just be like from who I follow or whatever, the type of people who are maybe loving the game or maybe hating the game. So in that way, it doesn't feel any bigger or, well, it does feel a little bit bigger, but it doesn't feel less than a 16 or, it certainly feels less than Remake, which definitely felt like, oh my God, this game is finally here.
Yes.
And we get to play it. But it's going to be interesting, I think, looking at the sales, looking at the trophy data, what kind of tail this game ultimately has, because like you said, 36% completion rate for Final Fantasy VII Remake. In my eyes, that's not a dreadful completion rate. I was, when we were talking about this before starting, I was looking at what I would describe as similar games that kind of veer between, you know, like 30 and 46 or something. So it's not well under, but if that drops for Rebirth, I do think we're having a problem. And I do think the approach to the Remake project, then I don't know if it's too late to change it, but if this feels
probably they're quite far along.
If people are dropping off to an even bigger degree, I think the way that they've expanded the game out ultimately might have been a bad idea. If people aren't sticking with it, like the content might even be great, but if people aren't sticking with it, was it the right move? I don't know.
That's the thing. If the sales go up and the completion, the chapter data stays low, then that's very telling. I mean, I think the first four chapters, I think it opens strong, first chapter, and then it languishes for a long time. Like, I think that's, you can see it in the data. You can see people drop off of those exact chapters, because why would you put up with that unless you're a Final Fantasy fan, or you're just dying to get through it? But we'll see what happens with it. I feel like, I'm just fascinated by the whole thing. For now, though, this has been not the Untitled Banner podcast. This has been the What Culture Gaming podcast.
It certainly has. Scott Dilford, thank you for having me on.
Yes, thank you very much for joining. I forget what the end of this podcast is, but a lovely roundup of news. I'm Scott Dilford.
I'm Josh.
Catch us throughout the week.
Only got one name.
Yeah.
Got our last name. Just Josh.
Have a lovely time. See you soon.
Like Prince.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.